Welcome back, everybody. Remember that in the previous lecture, we studied quantum field theory in the Schrödinger picture, in what amounts to the analog of what would be the position representation, namely in the field representation. This, I think, is useful to have seen. It can be quite useful in studies of quantum gravity. But in studies of quantum field theory for cosmology, it's not used that much. And so we return now to the Heisenberg picture. So we will study quantum field theory in the Heisenberg picture. And remember what it means to solve a quantum field theoretical problem in the Heisenberg picture. It means you have to solve three problems. The first is you need to find fields, that is to say, operator-valued functions of space and time that are Hermitian. If the field in question is classically real-valued, then it's quantumly self-adjoint value. And so we need these conditions, the Hermiticity conditions. We need to solve for fields that obey the canonical commutation relations. And we need to solve for fields that solve the equations of motion. And remember that the equations of motion are exactly the same as the classical equations of motion if we use the Heisenberg picture. Now, when we started working on this, we already noticed that it is beneficial to work with an infrared regularization and then to Fourier transform. So infrared regularization means that we consider only a finite box, a finite chunk of the universe, with side lengths of, let's say, capital L. And we impose, for simplicity, periodic boundary conditions. Other boundary conditions can also be chosen, and they have their own benefits. I will explain that later on. Then once we've implemented the infrared regularization, we do a Fourier transform. And it's a Fourier series transform now, because the functions live only in a finite interval or in a finite box. If we had the functions defined on all of R3, we would need a proper Fourier transform. But remember, and if you don't remember, look it up, that if you have a function that's defined only on an interval, then you can do a Fourier series expansion that's just as precise as is the Fourier transform for functions that live on the real line.
I don't know if it's better or not, but in the finite canonical commutative relations, we are using equal time commutative relations.
Equal and time.
Why not? Why do you consider this and not different time commutative relations?
You can calculate what the commutator is for different times, and you will find it's quite non-trivial, actually. It's non-trivial.
But
we only need to know it at equal time. And then we can calculate the time evolution of the fields. And as it happens, the time evolution will automatically preserve the commutation relations.
Even if you put different times?
No. If you choose here a different time than there, then the commutation relations are not those. Instead, you have a non-trivial function there, which for t going to t prime becomes the Dirac delta, but other than that, it's a non-trivial function.
And this non-trivial function, is it interesting? We can do something with that?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yes, sometimes it comes up in calculations, but you don't need to, you don't need to use it to define your theory. In order to define it, we just want to give the bare minimum of what we need to solve. We only need to solve this at one point in time, the equal time commutation relations. And then the equations of motion will carry us forward in time. And the canonical commutation relations are preserved automatically. And the reason why the canonical commutation relations are preserved is that the time evolution is unitary. And that's because the Hamiltonian is self-adjoint. Is everybody clear about why canonical commutation relations are always preserved under unitary time evolution? Did I show that quickly, how that works? You all know it?
The volume and phase space.
Okay, let me just show you. So imagine we have canonical commutation relations, and they could be of whatever form, right? So we have, let's say that we have a Q hat of T, and we have a P hat of T. Let's say, okay, we write this minus P hat of T, Q hat of T equal to IH bar, let's say, right? Now, let's say we have it at time T naught. So we solve this only at the initial time. And then we calculate what is Q hat of T. And we find that we can write this as U hat dagger of T, Q hat of T naught, and U hat of T. Right? In the Heisenberg picture, that's the time evolution of our observables. And the same is true for the P hat of T. It is also U hat dagger of T, P hat of T naught, and U hat of T. So now, let's see whether the time-dependent Qs, so at later times, still obey the canonical commutation relations. And the claim is, yes, they will automatically obey these commutation relations just on the grounds of the fact that the time evolution of Q is unitarily generated, and the time evolution of P is unitarily generated. And we can test that by now checking. So we take Q hat of T, P hat of T minus P hat of T, Q hat of T, and plug in what we have. So what we have is U hat dagger of T, Q hat of T naught, U hat of T, and then we have U hat dagger of T, and then we have P hat of T naught, and U hat of T minus U hat of T, P hat of T naught, U hat of T, U hat dagger of T, Q hat of T naught, U hat of T, right? Just substituting in the time evolution. And now that is a 1. And this is a 1. Right? So therefore, we have that this is U hat dagger of T, Q hat of T naught, P hat of T naught, in fact, the commutator of the two, U hat of T. Right? Because that goes away. And so we have Q hat of T naught, P hat of T naught. And here we have P hat of T naught, Q hat of T naught with a minus sign. So therefore, it's just this. But this is IH bar. And then here we have the, IH bar. All right? So times the identity. And that means that this is IH bar times U hat dagger of T, U hat of T. And so this is IH bar. So therefore, if the commutation relations are obeyed at one point in time, and if the time evolution is unitary, and that's guaranteed if U is the exponentiation of a self-adjoint Hamiltonian, then automatically the canonical commutation relations are preserved. And then once we have calculated what our Q hat of T is and P hat of T is, then, if you wish, you can calculate Q hat of T1, P hat of T2, right? Just substituting all of this in. And then you get something non-trivial. But you can calculate, because you have what these operators are as functions of time.
Mm-hmm. So, side question. There's work on theories that are non, the time evolution is non-unitary. So how would you construct preserve the commutation?
This is in one-to-one correspondence. So if the theory is unitary, then the canonical commutation relations are preserved. In fact, I wrote a paper on this like 20 years ago showing that, you know Noether's theorem. You know that for every symmetry, there's a conservation law. Now, quantum mechanics has, I mean, depending on the Hamiltonian, you have the one or the other symmetry. But every quantum mechanical system has one symmetry, which is that you can choose your basis whichever way you want. So you can always perform a unitary transformation on your system and look at it in a different basis. And you describe the same physics. And you can do a Noether kind of calculation and find out what is the conservation law that corresponds to the invariance of quantum theory under unitary transformations. And the answer is, it's the canonical commutation relations. The canonical commutation relations are the conserved quantities that correspond to the symmetry of quantum mechanics under the unitary transformations. So that means, indeed, that if no unitarity, you are violating the canonical commutation relations, which also means that if, against perhaps expectations, black holes can destroy information, and therefore quantum theory is actually non-unitary in the process of the formation and evaporation of and disappearance of a black hole, then it means that at some point, somewhere, the canonical commutation relations suffer. They will not be conserved.
Sorry, so in this case, this is like first quantization, but if these were fields, just like...
Same story, exactly. Absolutely, yes, because also for fields, remember, there's a Hamiltonian. You exponentiate it, you solve the Heisenberg equation of motion, you get a unitary time inversion operator, and they apply to the fields and so on. The Q of t could be, for example, you could choose for your Q hat of t, you could choose it to be the phi hat of some particular vector x and t, right? And then its canonically conjugate momentum p, etc. Right? So it doesn't matter. This is a completely general argument.
But for like a fermions, we have anti-commutation relations. Is that also corresponding to the unitary algorithm?
Yes, it is. And not only are these commutation relations preserved, but also others. Because you could take a commutation relation that's not simply AB minus BA, but you could take a commutation relation that's a polynomial of the variables in there. Right? And then what would happen is that whenever two variables are multiplied, you get a u times a u dagger automatically between any two variables. And they always annihilate each other, even if you have a 27 degree polynomial in Q and P. Right? They always annihilate each other. And you only get a u on the left and a u on the right that's left over of all of this. And then, so you basically can write any commutation relations in the form of f of q hat p hat equal to 0. Right? You just put the ih bar over here, then it's part of the polynomial. Right? And then you have f of u hat dagger q hat u hat. I'm dropping the time dependence here. It's exactly as it is here. And then you have here a u hat dagger, p hat, a u hat, right? This is true because all of these u hat and u hat daggers collapse, right? And what you have is that this thing becomes u hat dagger f of q hat p hat u hat equal to 0, right? This is a question mark. Is it true after the time evolution? And the answer is yes, because this is 0, right? So if this is 0, that is 0, and you put this in here, so all commutation relations or anti-commutation relations are preserved under unitary transformations. If you go back to classical mechanics, if you're so inclined that you still bother about the antique classical mechanics, there the role of unitary transformations is played by so-called canonical transformations. And what they, that's the symmetry of classical mechanics. And the conservation law there is that of the Poisson bracket. Right? It's actually the same, right? Poisson bracket is the commutator as a representation of the Poisson bracket. OK, so Okay, very quickly. Remember, in the Heisenberg picture, what we need to do to solve the problem is solve the hermeticity condition, the canonical commutation relations, and the equations of motion. To do this, we put a box cutoff, an infrared cutoff, and then we do a Fourier series expansion. And it's an expansion that requires only a summation in the momenta because we are restricting the field to a finite box. That's a Fourier series. Look it up in Wikipedia if you're not familiar with it, or better, in some actual paper on Fourier. Okay, so what that means is that the field phi hat of x and t can be written as a discrete sum over momentum fields, phi hat of k. And remember, it could be written as phi hat of k and t. But for historical reasons, in cosmology, we write the k as an index and not actually as one of the variables, but it is just one of the variables. So that's the Fourier transform from the momentum space to the position space, but there's also an inverse formula for that. And remember that these k values take these k vectors, these momentum vectors, take only values from a discrete momentum grid. Momentum space has been discretized by putting the system in position space into a box. Momentum space becomes discretized. Now, with that, in discretized momentum space, equations of motion become discretized in this way. So for every one of these discrete values of k, we have a harmonic oscillator, an independent harmonic oscillator. And we have canonical commutation relations. Each one of these harmonic oscillators has its own Hamiltonian, h index k. And the total Hamiltonian of the entire quantum field is the sum over these Hamiltonians. So the individual Hamiltonians for each one of these harmonic oscillators is just given by the p squared, and then the phi squared and k squared plus m squared. Remember this whole discussion that if we had stayed in the position representation, then we would not have had, we would not have a k squared here. We would have a Laplacian, a derivative. But by doing the Fourier transform, we just get a k squared, and that's just numbers. And therefore, this is literally the harmonic oscillator equation of motion, where this gives us the frequency squared, because that's the back driving force constant here. Yeah, and then the total Hamiltonian, the total energy of the Klein-Gordon field is given by the sum of the energies of these individual harmonic oscillators. That's this Hamiltonian. If we use this Hamiltonian in the Heisenberg equations of motion, so if you plug this Hamiltonian, just to remind you, into the Heisenberg equation of motion, which is this, is that I f hat dot of t is commutator of f hat of t with h hat of t. And we choose for f either phi hat of x and t, or we choose pi hat of x and t, then we get the two equations of motion, this one for pi and this one for phi. So this Hamiltonian is generating these equations of motion. And then, of course, we were able to go into the Schrödinger picture where this Hamiltonian would be used in the Schrödinger equation. But here we stay in the Heisenberg picture. Now we come to one of the most crucial observations. And it's something that in discussions of quantum field theory for particle physics, as it is used at CERN, is often mentioned too briefly, I think, because it's really a big deal. So let us look at these Hamiltonians here and at these wave equations. Let us pick one of the discrete momentum vectors, k. And then we have here a harmonic oscillator for that momentum. Remember, what's oscillating is the amplitude. But not in space. It's in momentum space, the amplitude, right? It's a Fourier coefficient here. And we can now ask, what are the energy eigenstates of this harmonic oscillator. Here is its Hamiltonian. And we know that its ground state is going to have the energy of 1/2 h bar omega, where the omega is given by square root of k squared plus m squared. How do we know that? Well, we know it because this is the back driving force constant, right? If you have a harmonic oscillator and this is the acceleration, that's the elongation, then that's the back driving force constant. And we know that the square root of this determines the frequency of our harmonic oscillator. So that's the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. We know the ground state has energy 1/2 h bar omega. The spectrum of this harmonic oscillator, the spectrum of this Hamiltonian is given by h bar omega k, because the frequency depends on k, and then 1/2 for the ground state, and then 3/2, 5/2, and so on. But this means, and that's now the crucial point, this means that the energy difference between the ground state and the first excited state is the same as the energy difference between the first excited state and the second excited state, and so on. And the energy difference is h bar omega k, right? 1 h bar omega k is the energy difference between whether this harmonic oscillator of that particular mode, of that particular wavelength, is either in the ground state, first excited state, or and so on. So let's spell that out. The energy difference between any two levels of the harmonic oscillator that corresponds to waves of a particular wavelength, k, is given by E equal to omega k. I'm dropping the h bar here. We're using units in which h bar has the numerical value 1, which is square root of k squared plus m squared. Now let's remember something. When we have a particle that has a mass m and momentum k, then what is its energy? The energy is square root of k squared plus m squared. That's relativistic kinematics, right? Remember that if you have a particle with a mass, then p naught squared minus p vector squared equal to m squared, which is to say that p naught is equal to square root of m squared plus p vector squared. Which means that if you take the harmonic oscillator for one particular wavelength, for one particular choice of k, and you raise it, its energy from the ground state to the first excited state, you have to invest exactly as much energy as if you were to create a particle with this mass and that momentum. If you were to excite this harmonic oscillator 7 more times, then you would have to pay 7 times this energy. It is as if you created 7 more particles of that mass and that momentum. This suggests, and it is the case, that we now have a bridge to the particle picture. So far, we've not talked about particles in quantum field theory. It was all about fields and the field configurations and the amplitudes and all of that. But now what we see here is that if we focus on one wavelength, on one momentum vector k, and that means, you know, plane waves of a particular fixed momentum vector, you know, that would be a wave e to the power I kx, right? So if we focus on a particular k, it has a harmonic oscillator, and then to excite that oscillator costs exactly as much energy as if you were creating particles. And therefore, it is suggestive to think that maybe this is what particles are. That particles are excitations of these harmonic oscillators. Now remember how we got there. We started out viewing the quantum field as being made out of harmonic oscillators. One harmonic oscillator at every location. And then we said, okay, these are all identical harmonic oscillators, but they are coupled to each other because of the Laplacian term. And then we said, oh, the Laplacian term is messing things up. We can't treat the harmonic oscillators independently because due to the Laplacian term, they see their neighbors. They're coupled to their neighbors. And to solve a system of coupled harmonic oscillators is harder than to solve a single independent harmonic oscillator. And it's harder especially because here we have a continuum of coupled harmonic oscillators. Yes, each one is coupled only to its infinitesimal neighbors, but it's still infinitely many of them. So that's messy. That's why we Fourier transformed the whole thing so that the Laplacian term became a k-squared term, which is just multiplying, and therefore that's just a number. For a fixed wave vector k, that's a fixed number. So we had independent harmonic oscillators. But these are harmonic oscillators whose amplitudes are the Fourier coefficients of the actual field. And so what we see is that we can describe the presence of a number of particles by describing it as the excitation of these harmonic oscillators in momentum space. But you see how this is highly non-trivial, because imagine if the harmonic oscillator was not harmonic, if it was an enharmonic oscillator. So its potential is not exactly phi squared. See, here it's exactly phi squared. We have a pi squared plus a phi squared term. So it's a harmonic oscillator. But if it was not exactly harmonic, then it would mean that the spacing between the energy levels would not be equidistant. And therefore, we could not apply that logic and say that, yeah, we're just creating particles, more and more particles. As we excite the harmonic oscillator, we create more particles of the same kind. They wouldn't be of the same kind, because they would come with a different energetic expense each time. But as it happens, this is what we get is harmonic oscillators. And as it happens, these harmonic oscillators have equidistant spacing. And so they invite an interpretation as the excitation of particles. We will later see that there is another way to get to the particle picture. But so far, I mean, that's the first bridge to a particle picture. So the hypothesis that we are working with for now is that mode excitation, so the excitation of one of those harmonic oscillators that corresponds to particular momentum k, is particle creation. Now remember, for water, an excitation can be measured by throwing a cork in there. For quantum fields, we can measure excitations by putting an atom in there and see whether the atom gets excited. We will do that in lecture 8, but today is lecture 5. We will do it in lecture 8, where we actually put an atom in there as a detecting mechanism to check whether or not in that field there are particles. Where an atom is not a universal detector, it's not able to detect all sorts of particles. It's only able to detect particles that it can absorb, so that it can go from a ground to excited state. For that, we need a resonance condition, as we will see.
So for this atom, are you describing it using non-relativistic quantum mechanics or fully relativistic?
For this?
Yeah,
but it's too early. Lecture 8. We will
so
not.
It's only like non-relativistic quantum mechanics, right?
No, actually, I wrote a paper with a former postdoc here on how to do that relativistically. It can be done.
Oh.
And the way you do that is that instead of using an atom, you can use an elementary particle that comes in two different energy levels. And then you can describe that with quantum field theory, and therefore the whole thing becomes covariant. So what we see here is that these harmonic oscillators, through their excitations, allow us to describe the presence of particles. At least that's a conjecture so far. But is this stable? And it turns out, kind of, but there are caveats to it. If all you ever do is work in inertial frames in Minkowski space, then that's fine. But in this course, we are concerned also with gravity and acceleration. And we will see that there, it's not as easy, because accelerations and curvature will mess with this. And what that means is that fundamentally, as we will later see, the presence of a particle, the very existence of particles, the notion of particle is not a stable one. It is observer dependent, and it's dependent on the curvature. Yeah?
So going back to the, you made a comment about the anharmonicity.
Yeah.
So if you have anharmonicity in your system, you're saying the particle hypothesis may not hold. It's not too clear to me. What if it's just a particle of a different frequency or a different energy? Or does it have to be equal spacing for it to be the same kind of particle?
Yes, it has to be equal spacing, because you classify particles by their mass. And if you were to account for it at different spacing, you know, the k is fixed or the p is fixed, then you would have to mess with the mass, right? And
the massless particle, like the photon. Then it's just
that is a whole different issue, actually. With massless particles, there are other issues that can come up there. But let me just tell you how we actually handle this then. Anharmonicities are normal. They do occur. We usually have Hamiltonians that have quadratic terms plus higher order terms. And when you have higher degree terms too, then what we do is we cut them off at the beginning, and we say we are not regarding those. We quantize the theory with just the quadratic terms, and we have a proper particle interpretation in this case. And then we go back and say, what did we miss? What did we miss? What happened with these anharmonicities? And what we find is that the anharmonicities are then interactions between the particles. So you either have non-interacting particles, if you could get away with this in a non-harmonic picture, but then you would have like infinitely many species of them. And it's not clear you could actually get away with this with the non-harmonicities. Or, as one is usually doing it, we say, okay, we consider just the harmonic part, and then consider the anharmonicities as perturbations of that, and that means it's the interaction between particles then.
So you're just saying, basically, it mixes, or like these terms, instead of diagonalizing in the basis and diagonalizing the full term, you just diagonalize or pick a basis in the bare terms or quadratic terms.
It's not a matter of choosing a basis. It's a matter of dividing up the Hamiltonian into a quadratic Hamiltonian plus the rest. And the quadratic Hamiltonian describes a free theory where the particles don't interact, but the particles are well defined in the way that we are doing now. And then on top of that, we have the interactions of particles, and the interactions are literally the description of the anharmonicity. Okay, so particle physics, as we do it at accelerators, is based on that special case where we don't have anharmonicities, as we said. And you describe, first of all, free quantum field theories with particles well-defined, and then you look into the interactions of them. So let us look at the free theories. Also because for cosmology, as it turns out, the free theories are the ones that matter most. So, for example, let us consider a state that we might call psi, in which we have, let's say, three particles of momentum Ka and seven particles of another momentum that we might call Kb. Of none of those particles do we know where they are, because we know the momentum of them, so we cannot know where they are, right? So they would be described as a plane wave that rolls everywhere. Here. Nice. Spatially, it's this. So let's say we want to describe, within quantum field theory, a state in which we have three particles of one momentum and seven particles of another momentum. How would we do that? Well, we can do it like this. We write down a state psi, which has the property that the Ka harmonic oscillator, the harmonic oscillator, where is it? Here. that the harmonic oscillator for the momentum Ka is in its third excited state. And we indicate that by saying that the occupation number n of the harmonic oscillator k index a is 3. So this harmonic oscillator is in its third excited state. The harmonic oscillator that corresponds to the momentum kb is in its seventh excited state. And all other harmonic oscillators are in their ground state. So the excitation level is 0. So they are in the lowest eigenstate of their Hamiltonian. And since all of these harmonic oscillators are independent, each one of these has its own Hilbert space, and the total Hilbert space of the quantum field theory is the tensor product of them. There is some non-triviality in taking infinitely many tensor products, but let's just skip over these issues that can arise with that. Especially if you have an infrared cutoff and discretized momentum space, then it's not so bad, and we can write down the tensor product. So the state psi that describes a state of 3 particles of this known momentum and 7 particles of this known momentum is the tensor product of the third excited state of this harmonic oscillator, the seventh excited state of this harmonic oscillator, and the ground states, the tensor product of the ground states of all the other harmonic oscillators of the quantum field. What if we take the Hamiltonian of one of these harmonic oscillators, let's say K, and act with it onto that psi? Well, then, if K is not the Ka, and if K is not the Kb, then it's the energy of one of these harmonic oscillators that's not excited. So if we apply that to psi, then we just get the ground state energy. That is, if K is not equal Ka or Kb. If we take the Hamiltonian to the harmonic oscillator of momentum Ka, then the energy that we get is the eigenvalue that we get. I mean, this is the description of the eigenvalues, right? Hk acting on psi is eigenvalue times psi. And the eigenvalue is 1/2 plus 3 h bar omega if we choose the k to be Ka. It's 1/2 plus 7 h bar omega if k is Kb. And the total energy of this state is the sum of all the energies of these harmonic oscillators. And that's all of the h bar omegas. This is a 1/2. All of the 1/2 h bar omegas of all the harmonic oscillators that are in their ground state. Each one of them contributes in principle 1/2 h bar omega. And then for these two excited harmonic oscillators, we get a 3 and a 7. So that's the total energy. Of course, this part is infinite here. But we can regulate that by introducing, if you want to, an ultraviolet cutoff. An ultraviolet cutoff is a cutoff on how small distances can get, or how large, correspondingly, the k can be. So if you have a largest k, then we're not summing over all, and this would be finite. Now, that state is a state with 3 particles of a particular momentum and 7 particles of a particular different momentum and nothing else. But we can also describe, for example, a situation where we would have a state where we have either 3 particles of one momentum Ka or 7 particles of momentum Kb. How do we describe that? Well, the state with definitely just 3 particles of momentum Ka is this state. It is occupation number of the Ka oscillator is 3. All others are in their ground state. That's the state where we have definitely 3 particles of momentum Ka. And then the state where we definitely have 7 particles of momentum Kb, that's this state. Only this harmonic oscillator is excited, namely to its 7th state. All the others are in the ground state. And if we have a state that's a linear superposition of having either 3 particles of this momentum or 7 particles of another momentum, that would be a linear combination of these two, where the coefficients have to be such, alpha and beta have to be such, that the whole thing is normalized. Right? So if we choose alpha arbitrarily, then beta has to be 1 minus, has to be square root of 1 minus alpha squared. So in quantum field theory, in principle, we can have states in which the number of particles is not predictable. Because in this state, well, it could either be 3 or it could be 7. In this state, we know the number of particles is 10. But here, we don't know. We might either, if we measure, we might either find 3 particles or 7 particles. That's not something we could describe with non-quantum field theory. It's just quantum mechanics. Now, for photons, you can do this. You can create in the lab states in which you either have 3 photons or 7. 3 of this momentum or 7 of that momentum. You can do that. But you cannot do that for electrons. You cannot create a state where you either have 3 electrons of some momentum or 7 electrons of some momentum, because there is something called, you know, there's a number, particle number conservation law, so-called super selection rules, where you can't actually do that. You can have an unknown number of electrons if you match it with an unknown number of positrons. The positrons contribute a negative 1 in the count of how many particles you have. Now, that's something to worry about if you are interested in quantum field theory for particle physics. There, it's very important what the conservation laws are, what you can have a superposition of, and so on. For the purpose of quantum field theory for cosmology, that is to say, for our course, we don't need to worry about the superselection rules because we are dealing mostly with scalar fields, namely this Klein-Gordon field, which will play the role of the Higgs field or the inflaton field. And there, we can have states of different particle numbers linear superposed. Now, if the existence of a particle of a particular momentum is the same as exciting one of these harmonic oscillators one more level, so if the creation of particles of particular momentum means that we have to excite the harmonic oscillator for that particular momentum, then the natural question to ask is, how can we make particles? And how can we destroy particles? And the answer has to be, well, we can make particles by exciting these harmonic oscillators. And there are two types of mechanism by which harmonic oscillators can be excited. Do you remember? We addressed it very briefly. Who wants to say it? Not everybody all at once. Maybe Sapir?
So parametric driving and forced driving.
External force driving.
Force driving.
Yes, that's right. So parametric driving would be, I hope that the thing doesn't die on me now, right? So the external force driving is this. If this is a pendulum, this is a poor pendulum, but OK, if this is a pendulum, right, I could drive it externally like this, right? And you all know how that works, right? I can do it like this. But I can also excite a harmonic oscillator, such as a pendulum, by changing a parameter of it. So for example, the length of a pendulum goes into the calculation of its natural resonance frequency. So if I change the length, I'm changing the frequency. And if I take a harmonic oscillator and I make one of its parameters time dependent, I can actually excite or unexcite that harmonic oscillator. So what that means is that if this thing is already oscillating, let's say, and I now pull on it in just the right rhythm, then I can actually make the amplitude larger. I can also pull the wrong rhythm, and then I can make the amplitude smaller. What I cannot do with a classical pendulum is to excite it parametrically from its ground state. Because if the pendulum is just hanging down like this, and I make the line shorter or longer, well, that doesn't mean that it will start swinging this way, right? But quantumly, I can excite it. And the reason is that quantumly, no harmonic oscillator is actually really in the zero position with zero elongation and zero velocity. Okay, and so we will see both of these things play out. I think I mentioned it briefly in the previous lecture. And today we will calculate it one way. And then in the rest of the course, we will calculate it the other way. So today, and I think also the next lecture, we will calculate the external driving force. It's more familiar. It's something that you've probably seen before, maybe not in that form. And we can introduce some concepts that will be useful later also for quantum field theory in curved background. So we have two types of mechanism. In order to keep things as simple as possible, I replaced the phi by the q again and the pi by the p or by the q dot, just to remind you how this works in ordinary quantum mechanics. It would be just confusing to carry extra indices around, work with all of the harmonic oscillators at once. We've already seen that if we do the infrared cutoff and a Fourier transform, then we get a lot of independent harmonic oscillators. And so let's just grab one of them. And what's the intuition of that? Let me just remind you of what the intuition is. If you grab one of the momentum harmonic oscillators of the quantum field, then it means that we are talking about one particular plane wave, like this. And we are asking about how much of that we get. Right? So that this has a Fourier coefficient, and we ask how much of that do we get. And therefore, how many particles of this particular momentum k do we get. All right, so now let's look at one individual harmonic oscillator and see how it can be driven. So if we have an external driving force, then this is the equation of motion. This would be the independent harmonic oscillator. Second derivative is equal to minus omega squared q. And then we add an external driving force. Now, in principle, the external driving force should have a hat on it, because everything in nature is quantum. So in particular, whatever is driving our harmonic oscillator is also quantum. Often, though, we can choose this to be effectively classical. As we will later see, that's an important case. For example, if you want to make the electromagnetic field, if you want to excite the electromagnetic field, you can use charges and currents. And as you know from classical electromagnetism, there are a ton of circumstances. Basically, it's normal that we can describe currents and charges classically, like a classical current. And that means that for the electromagnetic field, if this was one of the mode oscillators of the electromagnetic field, it's usually a very good approximation to put here charges and currents classically. Of course, in reality, they have to be quantized. And there are circumstances, of course, where that matters. OK, so that would be the external driving. That's like with the pendulum like this. And then there's the time dependence of omega, which can also be introduced. We can introduce a time dependence of omega. So we are making a parameter of the harmonic oscillator time dependent. So instead of adding a force, we don't add a force, but we make this thing time dependent. And that too can drive the harmonic oscillator. In fact, it can destroy the harmonic oscillator. It can turn it into something that's no longer a harmonic oscillator. Namely, imagine if the omega goes negative. If the omega goes imaginary, and therefore the omega square goes negative, and therefore that changes sign here. That changes everything. It's no longer a harmonic oscillator. Because it means that instead of getting sine and cosine as solutions for the time dependence, we would get the hyperbolic sine and the hyperbolic cosine. And they grow without bound. Instead of being oscillatory, they just grow. And why? Well, it's because, you see, if you flip the sign of this, it means that in the potential of the harmonic oscillator, you flip the sign of the potential. In the Hamiltonian, you flip the sign of the potential. And if you flip the sign of the potential, the harmonic oscillator is still described by a parabola, but it goes downwards. And that means you don't have any bound states anymore. And that tells you right away, no bound states, so therefore no normalizable states. Therefore, you have a continuum of states. So what you have is only scattering states now. And in particular, there is no gap between the energy levels anymore, which means there cannot be a particle interpretation. When that happens, when the potential flips, when this omega becomes imaginary, then the particle picture goes out the window. We still have the field picture. We can calculate everything about field observables, if there are, but no particles. And that can happen. In cosmology, this can happen. And it's an important phenomenon. And it will take us quite a few lectures to get to that point. But it's super important for inflation. Now, both of these mechanisms, external driving and parametric driving, do occur in nature. So for example, case A, external driving force, as we already discussed, this happens when particles interact with each other. So let's say we have two species of particles, such as electrons and photons, or such as, I don't know, quarks and electrons, and so on. And let's say you have two species of particles, one described by a field phi hat, and another species described by a field psi hat. Then you can write down the total Hamiltonian, which will be the Hamiltonian of the first field plus the Hamiltonian, or the free Hamiltonian of the second field, plus some so-called interaction Hamiltonian that contains both. And that term describes the energy that is involved when the two fields interact with each other. Remember, the Hamiltonian is just the sum total of all energies. And so there's the energy coming, the energy expense of having one field, the energy of expense for the other field, and then the energy expense or benefit from having both of them present. It doesn't have to be linear in both. I just, for simplicity, wrote it in this way. If we had, for example, the electron field interacting with the electromagnetic field, then it would be quadratic in the electron field, but linear in the electromagnetic field, because the interaction Hamiltonian then takes this form. It's psi bar a slash psi d3x, right? So that would be the case where one of them is the fermionic field of the electron field, and the other one is the electromagnetic field. The A is the electromagnetic field. OK, so the interpretation here is that, I mean, on one hand, you can see it as, in this case, it would be that you're shifting the harmonic oscillators in this case, right? But you could have higher order powers here, and then you would interpret it as an anharmonicity. But either way, we can interpret this as the interaction between fields. And the reason is that if you focus on the phi field, you get an equation like this, plus an extra term that comes from the psi. And if you focused on the psi field, you look at its equation of motion. It's also an harmonic oscillator, plus a J field, a different J field that depends on phi. So each field is a driving force for the other. And since each field can drive the other, it means that each field can excite the harmonic oscillators of the other. And that's what is mathematically behind the phenomenon that when two particles collide, then more particles can come out of it. It's simply that the harmonic oscillators of one field and the harmonic oscillators of the other field interact with each other and excite each other. And what's important here is, of course, resonance effects. Harmonic oscillators get the most easily excited if the exciting force is resonant. And what that means is that the energy of the ingoing particles, which determines the resonant, the oscillations frequencies of them, because the energy translates directly into the oscillation frequency. Remember that you have time dependence EI ET. Right? So that gives you the resonance frequency. And so the fact that you have resonant excitation translates into energy conservation. That's the same thing. When you don't have energy conservation, and there are circumstances where you don't, then you can have non-resonant excitation. So for example, you don't have energy conservation if your quantum field is an open system where you interfere from the outside with some other system that you're not describing as part of it, then the total in total energy might still be conserved, but for the subsystem that we are considering, it's not. Okay, but we are not doing this in this course. We are not doing the interaction between particles. For us, the focus is between the focus is on the interaction between gravity and accelerations and curvature on one hand, and quantum field theory on the other hand. So now we move on to B, the parametric excitation here. The presence of gravity can effectively influence these omega k's. And we have a wave interpretation and we have a particle interpretation of this. So for example, we have that the cosmic expansion stretches the wavelength. And that means that the frequency of each mode is decreasing. If you send a green laser light into space now, and you have a lot of patience, like on the order of billions of years, you will turn it into red laser light. Right. Also, if the wavelength, and that's going to be quite a dramatic effect, if the wavelength exceeds the cosmic horizon, then this omega squared becomes negative. The omega becomes imaginary. The harmonic oscillator becomes upside down, and the particle picture breaks down. That can happen, and it does happen, or it did happen anyway. So this happens when the wavelength that we are considering, the wavelength of the field we are considering, is larger than the horizon that we have because of the expansion of the universe. And the horizon is that distance beyond which you can no longer communicate. Because even if you try to communicate using light, which is the fastest there is, then the light is too slow. Because as it travels to your friend, the space between you and your friend is increasing more than the light per unit of time than the light can cross space. So when you have a laser beam whose wavelength is larger than that horizon size, then, as it turns out, we will calculate in detail, then that laser beam will stop oscillating. It just will stop completely to oscillate. And that's not even a quantum phenomenon. That's a classical phenomenon already. You could recreate. In fact, I would love to see that somebody does this. You could recreate the scenario of waves propagating on a background that's expanding. I don't know, you take a rubber band or something like this, or air that's expanding, or water, or Bose-Einstein condensate, and then observe the classical phenomenon that when you have waves on there, and these waves have a wavelength larger than the artificial horizon that you created, they should stop oscillating. Because that's just part of the classical wave equation already. And we will study that and the quantum consequences of that. Well, and then there's a particle interpretation of the fact that gravity can make the omega time dependent. Gravity could excite mode oscillators. So it could create particles from the vacuum, as it presumably does in the Hawking effect, but also the universe just doing its thing of expanding, that makes the omega slightly time dependent, and that could lead to particle production just on the basis of the time dependence of that omega. It's a subtle thing that we will also address. Okay, so now, let's get back to the external driving and study the external driving of a harmonic oscillator, of one harmonic oscillator in the Heisenberg picture. Okay, so that's the task now. We take one harmonic oscillator, and it could be the harmonic oscillator of one of these modes, but it can really be any harmonic oscillator. And we're describing it in the Heisenberg picture. And we are driving it externally. You could think of this as, for example, and I think that's a very important example, the harmonic oscillator that we are going to describe can be thought of as one mode of the electromagnetic field. And we want to excite that mode of the electromagnetic field. For example, through an external driving force that has the corresponding frequency. So for example, you want to, or momentum. So let's say you want to create an electromagnetic wave of a particular radio frequency with an antenna. Well, then you have to use an electric current that shoots up and down the antenna at that frequency, right? That will create the excitation. So let's model that. It's the external driving of one harmonic oscillator. So this is just saying, yes, it could be, for example, the electromagnetic field. We pick out one mode of the electromagnetic field, and we call it phi k of t. Now, you might complain and say, yeah, but the electromagnetic field is more complicated. It has, you know, Maxwell equations. They're more complicated, more components than the Klein-Gordon equation. But it turns out that the electromagnetic field's waves can be decomposed into two polarizations, each of which obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. So it is OK. It's actually a very good description of what happens electromagnetically. OK, so our harmonic oscillator, one harmonic oscillator for the mode k, has this Hamiltonian here. This is the Hamiltonian as we had it before, just for the free field. And now we added the driving force. You may wonder, why is it not just j here? Why is there a phi k times j k? Don't we have in the equation of motion that we just add a j here? Let's see. Right? Here, we just add a j. So why do we have down here a phi j? Any guesses what the answer might be?
Well, like if you think of a classical force, right? There's an operator, then this is the driving function associated with the oscillator.
Your intuition may be right, but what's the math reason for it?
Oh, that's how you create the particles. Well, you need a quantum description of how you're exciting the field.
Well, we're keeping this classical now. So what we already want is having a J here without a hat. And the answer is that this is not the Hamiltonian. This is the equation of motion, right? So in the equation of motion, we want to add just a J. But in the Hamiltonian, it means that we can't just add a j. Because if you add anything number value to the Hamiltonian, you might as well leave it out. Because it commutes with everything. It would not affect the equations of motion. So what you need to do in order to add a j in the equation of motion is that in the Hamiltonian, you add a phi hat times j. You see, if you now calculate the equation of motion for the pi dot, for the momentum dot, then it's the commutator of h with this and that. And the momentum now catches on this phi and just gives you the j. So this is just the right thing to add to the Hamiltonian, such that the equation of motion is the one that we want, the way where you just have the j on the right-hand side. So this is the Hamiltonian for one mode. And I wrote here in black what corresponds to what. So the h here is the hk. It's the Hamiltonian for one particular mode. The p squared is the pi squared, pi k squared. This stands for the phi k squared. And here, that's the driving force. But over here, we write j index k because it's the Fourier component of the current that we drive up and down the antenna. It's the Fourier component for the right frequency here. All right, so this is the Hamiltonian with an external driving force. Now, let's recall a few basics of Heisenberg quantum mechanics. I know some of you took my quantum course, so you know all this, of course, and others of you know it from other things. But just to be on the same page, let's go through that. Preparation for solving this problem completely. Actually, as we will see, it's quite remarkable that it is possible. We can solve in the Heisenberg picture the harmonic oscillator for arbitrary driving. So we can have an arbitrary driving force here, arbitrary time dependence of the driving force, and we can calculate exactly what happens with this harmonic oscillator. We can reduce the whole thing to just an integral. Okay, so how do we do that? Remember that in quantum mechanics, if f hat is any observable, and it could be in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, or it could be in quantum field theory, any observable. So it could be a phi hat, or it could be in ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics, a momentum or angular momentum or something like this. So for any observable in any quantum theory, we have that the expectation value as a function of time can be written as the state, which is frozen in the Heisenberg picture, sandwiching the time evolved original observable. F naught hat is the observable. It's the observable's operator at the initial time. That's the state at initial time. And of course, in the Heisenberg picture, that remains the state. And that's the time evolved operator, the time evolved observable. And the time evolution is calculated by solving the equation of motion for the time evolution operator, where this is the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. That's the usual differential equation for the time evolution operator with the initial condition that it's the identity operator at the initial time. In the Schrödinger picture, of course, we would bracket the same expression differently. We would write the bracket around the time evolution operator and the state, time evolution operator and the state. And then we would say that the observable is frozen in time, but the state evolves in time. Either way, equivalent. And in the Schrödinger picture, we would say that the dynamics is given by the Schrödinger equation. Here's the Schrödinger equation, where the Hamiltonian is the Schrödinger Hamiltonian. The Schrödinger Hamiltonian is obtained from the Heisenberg Hamiltonian in this way. And the two Hamiltonians are the same when the Hamiltonian is time independent. Now, we will use the Heisenberg picture, though, in which we bracket in this way, where the observable depends on time, and the state is frozen in time. So we have f hat of t, but the state is frozen in time. And the dynamics of the operators is given by the so-called Heisenberg equation of motion that we've had on the board a few times. There it is. Okay, so there is something unusual about the Heisenberg picture that most people don't quite visualize. And we need it in order not to be confused later on. So let's go through that carefully. As we said, in the Heisenberg picture, the state is frozen. And it's the observables that are time dependent, such as the Hamiltonian and any kind of observables, including the phi hats and the pi hats of the quantum fields. They are time dependent. But what that means now is this. An important implication of this, that since the observables change in time, their eigenbases can change in time as well. So the eigenbases of the observables, and for the Hamiltonian also the eigenvalues, can change. They can depend on time. So for generic observables and generic Hamiltonians, we have that the eigenstates are now time dependent. The state of the system doesn't depend on time, but the eigenstates of our observables depend on time simply because the observables depend on time. So for example, let's consider the driven harmonic oscillator. And let's say it starts out at time t1 in the nth energy state, which would correspond, for example, to having n particles in that mode, n particles of a particular momentum, if the harmonic oscillator is one of these mode oscillators. So let's say we have a driven harmonic oscillator that we describe in the Heisenberg picture. Its initial state is the nth eigenstate. And then, so at initial time t1, we have that the state of the system, gamma, is En of t1. So it's the nth eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian acting on the nth eigenstate is nth eigenvalue times the eigenstate. And since we are in the Heisenberg picture, gamma is always going to be the state that we are in. So gamma is the state En of t1, and it will always stay that state. And the system is always in that state. But at a later time, let's say t larger than t1, the Hamiltonian and its eigenvectors and eigenvalues can have changed. So the mth eigenvector at time t of the Hamiltonian has its eigenvalue and its eigenvector. And that might not be at all like the Em of t0 or m of t1, Em of t1. They may be orthogonal. They may be having some overlap. But in general, they are not the states. They're not the same states. En of t is in general not the same as En of t1. So for example, at the time t2, the system is, of course, since we're in the Heisenberg picture, still in the state gamma. And the state gamma is, of course, still the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian at the time t1. But the Hamiltonian has moved on. So that means that in general, the gamma is no longer the nth eigenstate of the Hamiltonian later on. It was, but later it's no longer. And so the fact that the system might have become more excited or less excited, that while it started out in the nth excited state, may no longer be true later on. It may no longer be in the nth excited state because excitation or de-excitation may have taken place. Is now no longer encoded in the state of the system. It's encoded in the operators and how the operators have changed over time. So for example, the system may start out at time t1 in the lowest energy state, let's say in the vacuum state. So let's say the state of the system is prepared to be gamma, which is the ground state at time t1. But at time t2, that's no longer the ground state. So our system has been excited. We wouldn't be able to tell, though, from the state gamma, because it's still in the original state. So now, what strategy can we apply to solve the quantized driven harmonic oscillator? Remember, the Heisenberg picture, what we have to do is preserve the obey the canonical commutation relations while obeying the hermeticity conditions. Using this Hamiltonian, we must fulfill the Heisenberg equations of motion, which for our driven harmonic oscillator turn out to be these. Q dot is still P, and P dot is this plus the extra driving force term, which we chose to be classical. Right? There's no hat over it, just classical. Later we will see under which condition we can do this, what it takes to describe something that's truly quantum as in a good approximation as something that is just a number-valued function. Now you've all seen that the harmonic oscillator problem can be solved with so-called A and A dagger operators. But how do we derive that? You've seen it probably fall from the sky. Somebody says, let's define this. And then it works magically, and you don't know. Why do we have a prefactor of 1 over 2 square root of 1 over square root of 2 omega h bar? Where does this come from, right? So now we need to solve the harmonic oscillator again. We will again find it convenient to use Einer dagger operators. But let's derive how they come about and exactly how we use them. It's important because later on we will see that there are different ways we can do that with the Einer dagger operators. And these describe different physics And the difference can make the difference between having a star or having a black hole, having no Hawking radiation or having Hawking radiation. So let's be very careful with introducing these A and A dagger operators. Okay, so the overarching idea here is we want to solve that problem. And for that purpose, we will introduce a variable that we will call A of t. And we define it to be a linear combination of the q hat and the p hat operators. I mean, what we really want is to find out what is q hat of t and what is p hat of t. That's ultimately what we need, because it's the Heisenberg picture. We want the dynamics of the q hat of t and the p hat of t. But instead of solving for the q hat of t and then solving for the p hat of t, we combine the two of them into one variable. That will turn out to be very convenient. It's a bit as if we say, we are trying to solve for two real-valued functions. What if we choose one as the real part of a complex variable and the other as the imaginary part of a complex variable? Then we have only one function now, which is complex-valued, and we can easily retrieve the real part and easily retrieve the imaginary part from that. Same deal here. The q hat is self-adjoint. The p hat is self-adjoint. So here we have a real number times a self-adjoint plus imaginary number times self-adjoint. So we can easily retrieve the q hat and the p hat from the A. So first of all, the naive idea is, instead of trying to solve for q and p separately, let's combine them into one variable. Now, there's a ton of ways we can do this. We can choose this real number alpha any which way we want, real number beta in any which way we want. In fact, we could even choose them complex, but we will choose them real. So we have a complete freedom here in choosing the alphas and the betas, and we will now choose that freedom. We will use that freedom to make life as easy as possible to solve the harmonic oscillator completely for any arbitrary driving force. See, so how can we determine what the best choice of the alphas and the betas is? First, let me remind you that if we define the A like this, and we succeed, and we find what A of t is, we can solve the dynamics for A of t, then we immediately get back what the q hat and what the p hat is. And the reason is that this equation and its Hermitian conjugate can be solved to obtain q hat as a linear combination of A and A dagger, and p hat as another linear combination of A and A dagger. So once we have succeeded in calculating A of t, there's no hat on it traditionally, but it should have a hat because it's really operator valued. In any case, if we succeed in calculating it, then we can get back the q hat and the p hat. So now, let's see. What do we need to do? We need to get the hermeticity right, and we need to get the canonical commutation relations and the equations of motion. Hermeticity is trivial. As soon as we take alpha and beta to be real valued, we are in business, because if alpha is real valued, this is self-adjoint, because it's A plus A dagger. And if we choose beta to be real, then that's also self-adjoint, because A dagger minus A is anti-self-adjoint. Right? If you take the Hermitian conjugate, you pick up a minus sign, because this becomes that, and that becomes this term. But you have an I in front, so the whole thing stays the same. So by choosing alpha and beta real, we obey the hermeticity conditions. Now, let's check what we need to choose for alpha and beta so that we get the canonical commutation relations. So we plug this q hat and this p hat into the condition that the commutator between q and p is ih bar. And then what we obtain is that the A and the A dagger have to obey this, 2 alpha beta. Now, we know that it is nice if the A and A daggers have a 1 on the right-hand side, because then we can use a lot of literature on these guys. So we choose alpha and beta such that 2 alpha beta is 1. So in other words, we choose alpha to be arbitrary, and then beta to be, and then 2 beta to be 1 over alpha. So we choose beta to be 1 over 2 alpha. So now we have already fixed the beta. We fixed that both of them have to be real. We fixed that beta is 1 over 2 alpha, no matter what alpha is, we still have a freedom to choose alpha. Now, how might we want to choose the alpha? Let us take the Hamiltonian, here it is, and let's write it in terms of the new variable A. Now, when we do that, then here we have to plug in what we have for P, namely this expression, P squared. That becomes this term. And then here we have omega squared half Q hat squared. Omega half Q hat squared, here's the Q hat, it's this. So we plug that in here, we get that term. And then we have another Q over here, Q times J. So we have J of T, and here's a Q. At this point, it looks like we didn't really do something wise, because that looks much more complicated, right? I mean, the Hamiltonian, the original Hamiltonian is already a little lengthy, but this one is much longer, especially if you spell out all of these squares here. But it turns out that the whole thing can be made to collapse. How? Let's say we write out what that is. What do we get? We get an A dagger squared. We get an A squared, and we get mixed terms with a minus sign. Here, we also get an A dagger squared, and we get an A squared, and we get the mixed terms with a plus sign. The interesting thing being that here we get A dagger squared with a prefactor, and here we get A dagger squared with a prefactor. And it's the same prefactors as what we get when we look at the A squared and the A squared terms there. In other words, if we arrange these prefactors to sum up just right, then the A dagger squareds are zero, have a zero in front of them, and the A squared terms also have a zero in front of them. And that's exactly happening if we choose this minus 1 half alpha squared to be, you know, the omega squared half over 4 alpha squared. So if we say that this sum is equal to 0, then the A dagger squared terms, this term and that term, sum up to 0. And that squared term and that squared term sum up to 0. The mixed terms don't sum up to 0, because the mixed term here comes with a different sign as the mixed term over there. So we are left with just the mixed term up here. Just the mixed term. Down here we have what we have. All right? So now, this is the condition that we need in order for all of these cancellations to take place, for the A dagger squares and the A squared terms to go away. But that's a condition on alpha. And it's the condition that alpha is square root of omega half. And therefore, because we calculated beta already as a function of alpha, the beta has to be this, which means we've just derived that the most convenient expression, the most convenient definition of a variable A is with these prefactors here, because it guarantees hermeticity, commutation relations are easy, and the Hamiltonian simplifies. Namely, the Hamiltonian now becomes this one, and that's an easy one. Right? There's just a mixed terms left over here. And that's the interaction term with the external driving force. So that's the Hamiltonian that we now deal with. And you notice it has just A dagger A in it. Just one term. Because the original Hamiltonian had a P squared and a Q squared. Here it's just the A dagger A plus 1/2. And you recognize probably that this is a number operator, and then, you know, that's just having number operator has the natural numbers as its eigenvalues, and so you get the h bar omega half plus an integer as the usual spectrum. We could have done the same argument without a driving force, and we would have derived the same conclusion. We would have arrived at the same conclusions, namely that this is the way we should define the A's and the A daggers. But notice that this was a matter of human convenience. We could have chosen different betas and alphas, and then we would have a hell of a job to solve it all, but it would be the same physics. Now, So the Hamiltonian simplifies now to this expression. And we can now solve the equation of motion for A of t. We have the Hamiltonian here. And we have the Heisenberg equations of motion, this one. And we have now to solve only one of them. Because instead of solving for q hat and for p hat separately, so that we get two coupled differential equations, instead we just have one differential equation for this one variable a. So if we choose for f hat the a, plug that into the Heisenberg equation of motion, then what do we get? Then we get that the I times the time derivative of a, that's this, is equal to the commutator of a with this Hamiltonian. Now, what do we get? We have the commutator of a with this. Well, it commutes with the 1 half. It commutes with itself. Doesn't commute with the a dagger. That gives us a 1. So we get an omega a, right? Because the a dagger gets eaten up by the commutator of a with a dagger. And here, well, we have to calculate the commutator of a with h, the commutator of a with this. Well, it commutes with itself, so that goes away. The commutator of a with a dagger is just the 1. So we are just left with this term here. So we get a minus this. So the equation of motion for a of t is simply this one. Now, if there was no driving force, it would be easy to solve this one. The solution to this differential equation for a, that is to say for the undisturbed harmonic oscillator, is of course given by this expression here. A of t is some initial a. I'm writing here in for initial. It's this initial a at time t0, t equal to 0, and then this factor here in order to make this factor appear. On the other hand, if that term was absent, and this was the time derivative, we would have a term like this. And we have both of them, and so we get that. Please check that this really pans out. It's not quite trivial, because in this term, we have t occur twice. We have to differentiate with respect to the t in here. If we do, we get an I omega in front, just like here. We get a minus I omega in front, because we have a minus t I omega, minus I omega in front here. And that's what we need in order to make that work out. But we also get a time derivative with respect to the t here that is the integration boundary, right? And what happens if you differentiate that with respect to t? Well, then your t prime becomes t. You get rid of the integral. If you differentiate an integral like that with respect to the upper integration boundary, then you get rid of the integral, and the t prime becomes t. So that becomes just the identity, and you have the j, and that is this term over here. OK, so we've solved for the a of t for all time independently, or let's say for all possible driving force functions. We can choose for the j whatever driving force we want. Nope. I think that's very cool because, see, we don't need to solve any differential equations anymore. You can take a driving force function, which might be, like this. I'm not driving, and boof, boof. This is whatever function you want. Could be a driving force function like this. And then you calculate it, let's say the driving force acts until time t or whatever, capital T. And then you've worked out what that integral is. And then you know exactly what a of t is. A of t is the original a times this plus the identity operator times a number that you can calculate. And all of the excitation that happened because you were driving this, for example, all of what you did with shooting a current up and down an antenna, all of what that did to the mode oscillator is encapsulated in that integral in here. And of course, we will later exploit, you know, what that means in order to draw physical conclusions for what an antenna will do when you shoot current up and down, a classical current up and down, in order to create photons of a particular momentum. Because remember, this is the harmonic oscillator for the mode oscillator of the electromagnetic field or Klein-Gordon field for particular momentum. So we are asking, you know, how does an external driving force excite particles? How does it excite the field that corresponds to particular wavelength and the particles that correspond to that particular wavelength? So we can use now a little definition here. We define the cumulative effect of the driving force. So we integrate this up for the time it takes for the driving force to end. Let's call this time capital T. We just integrate up all of that integral all the way up to time capital T. And then we know that before the driving force kicked in, this thing was not contributing. So before the driving force kicks in, it's just this, just the harmonic oscillator independent of anything else. That's the only time dependence that we have in the Q and the P or in the A if there's no driving force acting. Then while the driving force is acting, so for T inside the interval from 0 to capital T, the answer to the question, what is A of T, is given by that expression where T changes from, you know, T equals 0 to capital T. And it's a number that's growing, a complex number that's growing. And then after the driving force has stopped doing its job, then this integral doesn't change anymore because the driving force has finished. So all we get is the integral from 0 to capital T for all times, so for T larger than capital T. We have that the A of T is given by the A in times this plus J naught times this phase factor here. So the J naught is the cumulative effect of the driving force. And as we will later see, just to anticipate a key result that we get here, so we will later see, what this means is that when you excite the electromagnetic field with a classical driving force, with classical currents, classical charges that you shoot up and down an antenna, then no matter how you do it, no matter what the time dependence is of your driving the charges and the currents up and down the antenna, no matter what the J of T is, it all boils down, when it's all said and done, it all boils down to a J naught. You get this A, and as we will later see, this means that the electromagnetic field ends up in what is called the coherent state. A coherent state. That's super important, because if you remember coherent states, these are states that extremize the uncertainty principle. These are states that are as classical as possible, right? For the electromagnetic fields, it means that the uncertainty in the electric field and the uncertainty in the magnetic field is as small as it can be, as small as it is allowed to be by the uncertainty principle, a commutation relation between the E and the B. So it's as classical as possible. And that's the reason why, when we do electronics, when we use smartphones and so on, we can usually disregard the quantum nature of the electromagnetic field, because it's essentially in a coherent state. And as such, we can replace the E hat operator valued fields for the electric field by just E's, by expectation values, and the same for the B. And so the usual electromagnetism engineering can be used. However, while this is true whenever the J is classical, not all charges are classical, right? Not all charges are behaving classically. Not all currents can be described very well as classical currents. And so there is the possibility to create waves, electromagnetic waves, that are not coherent states, and therefore that we cannot simply describe as an E field and a B field without hats on it. And those we cannot just put in the Schrödinger equation, because it's non-classical light. It's quantum light. That happens, for example, when an atom is excited and it decays, and it sends out a photon. You see, in principle, it's the charge and current of the electron that goes from an outer orbit to a lower orbit that is creating the electromagnetic field, that is creating the photon. But it's not creating a coherent state. That light is not classical light. Anyway, we will do that later. OK, so here the message was, as long as you classically excite a harmonic oscillator externally, you will only create coherent states. I mean, so far we've not proven that. We've only proven that we can solve it. This is what we get. And we will later see that what we get is coherent states because of that. OK? Any questions? So let's officially end the lecture here, and then we can still continue to discuss.